Studios with beautiful artwork from local artists, great music, and drinks and snacks. Also, get a chance to tour our legendary station. The First Friday Art Walk is in Portland's vibrant East Side Arts District and includes more than 23 galleries. Hop just around the corner to the Art Walk event at the Jupiter Hotel. You can find a map of participating galleries at firstfridaypdx.org. So come out to KBOO in the name of art, music, and drinks. Friday, November 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. See you then!
This is KBOO Portland, and time out at 8 o'clock. And coming up next, it's the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show, where they'll discuss the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of your calls.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stop the Climate Crisis and War on Tuesday, November 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland. Stop the Climate Crisis and War is a forum and panel discussion which will link the issues of climate change and war, update the community on U.S. belligerence in Iran and Venezuela, focus on the U.S.'s role in the war on Yemen and presence in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, and more. Again, that's Stop the Climate Crisis and War on Tuesday, November 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Augustana Lutheran Church, 2710 Northeast 14th Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Good morning. Oh, it's windy. It's like windy. I love it. Okay, well, this is KBOO 90.7 on FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. I'm Joe Uris, and I can't deny it. The number to call to talk on the air is 231-8187. I got a lot of stuff to deal with, and I decided today, despite the bizarreness of Trump, I will make one mention. We owe it to the Kurds that Baghdadi got caught. And, of course, this was done after the Trump insanely opened up the northern Iraq, northern Syria to the Turks. And the chaos that ensues is still going on. And yet, a very striking attack on Baghdadi, where he was, his home was raided by very brave soldiers of the United States coming in on multiple helicopters. And even though Trump hates dogs, he praised the dog that was used in chasing him down in a tunnel. Baghdadi and three of his children were self-destroyed with a vest, though we don't yet quite know how that went down. We also don't know exactly what he was trying to do, running into a dead-end tunnel. All of that irrelevant to what I want to talk about. So, I want to look at local stuff, and there's a lot of local stuff to look at. And a lot of it is discouraging, and a lot of it is almost humiliating. I want to talk first of all, start out with talking about Harriet Tubman Middle School. When, many years ago, when there was a great struggle to try to stop the busing of African-American children out of Albina and other neighborhoods into a more, white schools in the city and elsewhere, Beaverton and so on, many people in the Black United Front and others supporting that movement, and most particularly Ron Herndon, who was then leader of that organization, fought hard to create a new middle school that would be representative of and interested in better education for African-American children, and most importantly, not having to force them into busing as a role of second-classness for them. It was a good idea, but it never quite was successful because the schools never quite came across, and the fight that went on and on and on did not lead to an enlightened approach to creating a new middle school. Now, finally, there is a return to that idea, a return to a concept of a middle school for not specifically a particular ethnic group, but for the area which is served, Albina, Irvington, and other areas, which vary enormously in economic force. But here's the problem. The Harriet Tubman Middle School that they have created sits on the edge of the I-5 freeway. On the edge, literally. Remember, this is intended as the ideal place to have kids get a good education. And yet, it is a place ridden with diesel fumes. And when I say ridden, I am not exaggerating. Oregon is the only state between, well, the state between Washington and California that does not require diesel filters on its big trucks. And the result of that, if you've ever been on I-5 heading north beyond the Coliseum, is not only do you have a totally stalled traffic situation, there's no bridge that's adequate, not only do you have that, but in fact, you have this vast toxic fume level in that area. And that means that these children in this school at this time face for real a toxic environment. And there's been a lot of evidence that this is a really serious long-term problem, and it has not adequately been addressed either, I don't believe, by the schools or others. Now, I would invite anyone who would disagree with this to give us a call to show us how they are figuring out a way to get rid of the toxicity at Harriet Tubman Middle School. Particularly, let's say they manage to filter all the diesel particulates and so on out of the air going into the school. But what do they do for gym? What do they do for play field activity? How do they protect the children there? And let's be clear about this. Diesel particulates make you stupid. I want to repeat that because people may not understand that. I'm going to cut through all the science. Diesel particulates make you stupid.
And sick.
And sick.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, you're here.
I am.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this now means that children will not only have to cross dangerous streets to get from the further east places to the Harriet Tubman Middle School, but also will exist in a campus which is potentially a toxic minefield. This is very disturbing. To me, this is insane. The simplest solution to it, of course, would have been to build a fast bridge, to create a fast commuter service for railroad going from Vancouver to the center of Portland, to have, by the way, put the MAX under the city. It would have been expensive, but when it should have been done, it would have been a lot cheaper than it will be if they try to do it now. Running essentially from Lloyd Center approximately into the far end of downtown. This would allow longer trains, faster trains, better commutes out to places like all the tech outfits in the valley. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It should have happened, but it didn't.
And now they're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
But they won't.
I want to make a broader point with regard to what you're talking about at Harriet Tubman Middle School and the diesel presence of diesel particulates
sure.
and so on. This is no accident, and unfortunately it fits a long-established and very predictable pattern. And what I mean by that is the people who inevitably bear the brunt of environmental degradation and the subsequent health problems that go with it are inevitably poor communities and communities of color, time and time and time again. We see that in the history here in Portland with the decision of where to route I-5 when it was put in.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Over and over and over again, we see this everywhere you look. And this, I think, is one of the principles behind an aspect of the Green New Deal. I think we're all familiar with the Green New Deal at this point. The Green New Deal has come in under criticism from the right because of the very large social and environmental justice components inherent in that legislation.
Right.
Well, I shouldn't call it legislation at this point.
Well, it's a proposal yeah. with details not stated.
Yeah. And the idea is, and it represents a realization, I think, that was a long time in coming for many people, is that the struggle for sustainability and environmental restoration and the struggle against poverty and racial discrimination are two sides of a coin. You really, if you're going to address one, you can't address one without addressing the other. Why? For the reason I just stated, that every single time it seems we have an issue like this arise, the victims are inevitably poor or non-white, or both.
Yeah, no, and remember the history of albina. The original problem, it's not a problem, the original phenomenon begins in World War II when a large population of African Americans were encouraged to come to Portland to work in the shipyards and other in defense industries for very good wages.
Yeah.
So you had an influx of African Americans. They worked hard. There were two large housing projects to house people coming for that purpose. The one that's really relevant was the city of Vanport, which became at one point the second largest city.
Yeah.
And it was in where it is now Delta Park.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, in 1948, due to a lack of care, a lack of concern, and many people think a deliberate effort, I don't agree with that, but a lack of absolute safety concern, the dike failed, Vanport was flooded, and that huge population was forced out.
Memorial Day, 1948.
Yeah, and the deal with that was the city of Vanport was always segregated. There was a main street with stores, and there was a black half and a white half. And that segregation pattern persisted. The black community was forced, literally forced, if they wished to survive, into Albina area, which was, of course, redlined. That is, that was the neighborhood that black people could rent in, that was the neighborhood they could buy in, and there were no other neighborhoods that would encourage or tolerate that community. So you have an isolated community. It actually, in many ways, flourished, as is an irony of segregation. There was a big jazz scene, a big music scene, a big scene on the streets of Albina. But then came the freeway. The freeway slashed its way through there. That's the I-5 freeway, mm-hmm. destroying the centers of much of that. And then the final blow was the effort by the Emanuel Hospital, the legacy outfit today, to level many, many blocks there in anticipation of building a super-duper medical center. Many of those blocks are still empty. You can go drive by there and see that. The center of Albina was hollowed out, and now what that neighborhood is, aside from the Harriet Tubman Middle School and the little areas isolated in that neighborhood, now what that neighborhood is, noticeably, is the new generation of white, quasi-hip, fairly wealthy people who walk and enjoy the wonderful streets.
Quasi-hip. Look at the judgment from Joe today.
Well, yeah, hip, I don't know what that even means anymore.
But you feel free to modify it with quasi.
Well, I do, because where is the enormous creative energy? Where is the concern for minorities?
I know, but you just said you were unable to be the arbiter of what is hip. Some of the people on North Mississippi Avenue are actually hip and not quasi-hip. That's all I'm saying. That's an aesthetic quibble I have with you.
Yeah, you evidently. You got up on the wrong side of bed today, eh?
Yeah, I want to inject something into this conversation that's related,
okay,
a little bit tangentially, but I feel the need to interject it because it touches upon me personally. And that is, my brother and sister-in-law live in western Sonoma County, California.
Oh, my God.
In a little town called Forestville. And they are in the evacuation zone for the Kincaid fire that is burning there.
Right.
A couple of days ago, they got the evacuation order, and they got out. Thankfully, they're okay. They're staying with some family members out of the area. But what I want to get is, and this isn't in a similar vein to what's happening to the kids at Harriet Tubman School, and what has happened fits this pattern of corporate excess victimizing everybody else, right? Pacific Gas and Electric Company, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this story, has an absolutely abysmal record on issues of safety, of due diligence, of maintenance, the prevention of large-scale disasters. They were found at fault last year for the campfire that burned the city of Paradise to the ground.
Right.
You remember all this, okay? Yeah. Again and again and again over the years, you see this problem with PG&E. They haven't done their due diligence. They haven't kept their power grid maintained. They haven't kept their lines and infrastructure free of trees and brush. In 2010, they had a gas facility in San Bruno, south of San Francisco, that exploded. killed 8 people. Since that time, they went on to falsify their records about their gas line and infrastructure maintenance. They were found guilty in a subsequent court ruling about that. And going back even farther in time, they were found guilty of poisoning a number of people in a small town with PCBs from their electric infrastructure. There was an award-winning Hollywood film starring Julia Roberts, Aaron Brockovich. Maybe you've seen it.
Yeah,
all this movie. All this is to say that here's a corporation with an abysmal track record that ends up killing people and destroying vast swaths of the landscape. Over the same period since that 2010 explosion in San Bruno, PG&E has paid their shareholders close to $5 billion over that time, even as they've let their infrastructure decay, even as they have been the prime mover in these natural and sociological disasters that have swept over parts of California. So, you know, this is all of a piece in my mind, right?
Well, I think it is.
Yes,
I think it is.
This is, once again, a question of profit being elevated at the expense of everybody else. PG&E, when asked why they hadn't put in the due diligence to maintain their power grid, said that they balked at the price, that it was going to be a multi-billion dollar endeavor. But they didn't hesitate to pay multi-billions of dollars to their shareholders over that same period of time. So now my brother, his wife, and other members of their family have had to flee their homes to go live somewhere else. And here's the kicker, right? Much of California, particularly Northern California, and many parts of rural Northern California, and in urbanized Northern California, the Bay Area, for God's sake, have been placed under rolling blackouts by PG&E, ironically, because of the high fire danger posed by their own lack of diligence in maintaining their power grid, right? So news reports out of the Sonoma County area with regards to this fire evacuation are saying because of the blackout, it's compounding and making more complicated the evacuation effort. And officials are worried that they're not going to be able to reach people they need to evacuate because they don't have any electricity. It's just a maddening situation.
Well, it's beyond maddening. It's very frightening. And it was all preventable. And it's important to understand that this is not an accident or an aberration. This is capitalism at its best.
Oh, at its absolute finest. It's functioning as designed. If you think this is a problem with the system, you're wrong. It's working perfectly. PG&E shareholders are enriched the way they signed up to be when they became shareholders.
And in case you think, well, this is all aberrant and, you know, odd and so on, there's more from Portland. Realize that if you happen to be around Reed College, let's say, in Woodstock, a very, very nice neighborhood, many of the side streets are unpaved. If you go out beyond 82nd into Lentz and other areas, you discover some of the streets are unpaved, but moreover, there aren't adequate sidewalks, there aren't adequate signals. People are literally dying because of that. And the city now, here's what's really getting me, has decided, in their infinite wisdom, well, we do need a bridge for bicyclists and walking, which I'm not against, that will cross the I-84 freeway at 9th Avenue and will go all the way beyond Ainsworth. And that street will be specially redesigned with traffic calming. Now, does the neighborhood, what's remnant of the remaining black community to the north, like that? Were they asked? Did they get to vote? No. There have been 3 meetings in which, this blows my mind, actually. These young, smart people, probably trained at urban studies at Portland State or wherever, come to them and tell them, oh, it's going to be so pretty, we're going to have all these things. It was a third meeting that I actually attended. People are really upset. People are really angry. This is not what they want. But it doesn't matter. The city has decided that there needs to be this particular thing. This, despite the enormous availability of bicycle lanes to the west of that. It doesn't matter, though. They're going to build this. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to be very pretty, maybe. And it's going to be a real hassle for people on 8th or 10th streets on either side of that, because the parking structure will be much reduced. And the whole thing will be pretty, which is great for the real estate business, but is not going to do much for people who actually live in the neighborhood. And it's not, don't misunderstand me, I'm not at all against people walking, nor am I against people using bicycles. I think they're both great ways of transporting oneself. The problem is that the city has no coherent plan. When you have city streets that are unpaved, when you have city streets that have no signals, when you have city streets without sidewalks, those things must be taken care of first before you get into the niceties, as far as I'm concerned. And this really upsets me because it's so Portland. And I like to hear from people out there.
Let's go to the phones.
Yeah.
Robbie, good morning.
Oh, Robbie. Robbie,
call us back if you can, Robbie. Who's next?
Oh, my goodness. I drove everybody away.
Yeah, they got tired of listening to you.
Oh, thanks a lot. You got up on the wrong side of whatever it was you were sleeping on.
It was a rough morning this morning.
Whatever bad. Yeah, how are things?
Things are good, thank you.
Good.
Happy to be here.
Yeah.
This is the Abe and Joe Show. If you weren't aware of that fact, this is also KBOO 90.7 FM. Also, a very important fact. You can also choose to support this station. Did you know that, Joe?
I didn't. I had no idea.
Oh yeah, you did. Don't play coy with me.
No, I don't. I think it's all free.
Visit the website.
The government gives us money.
No. KBOO 90.7 FM. KBOO.FM. Click on the Donate Now button. You can support this station. We need it. We need your help. We really do. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio, Harvard professor Dr. Cornel West discusses...
Oh, I like Cornel West so much.
Controversial figure. I like him too.
Oh, no, he's a cool guy.
Yeah. Discusses seeking the truth by challenging assumptions and raising the most difficult questions. At 10 on Flashpoints, they spend the hour with award-winning Palestinian-American poet, essayist, and children's book author Naomi Shihanai. And at 11, Stage and Studio, D-May features the 67th season of Lakewood Theater Company with Shakespeare in Love. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews Linda Tesner, curator of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art. All this and more coming up on your community-supported radio station, KBOO.
Yeah, it's really this is actually a cool station. People probably don't know, but you and I, we volunteer.
We do.
I don't get paid.
No.
It was a shock to discover that, but
wait,
you know.
Wait, you don't?
Well, whoa, you mean you're being paid?
No.
Whoa. Okay, right. Let's get back. I want to reiterate my points because they really are local, but at the same time, as you pointed out, reflect a whole host of problems that are typical of what modern American capitalism is about. The first point I want to make is that we are not having a citywide plan for development where areas have been neglected and ill-treated. And this is really important. We're making nice in some neighborhoods, not so nice, in fact, doing nothing in others. Though the city swears it's got plans, it's going to be building stuff, it's going to be making sidewalks, it's going to be building streets, actual streets, it's going to have signals. But I'm truly distrustful and truly dismayed at the way in which the city operates. And it is all of it very, very arrogant and very much a technocratic pipe dream rather than a practical effort to make the city a better place. And this really bothers me. So let's give people a chance to call. 231-8187. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to get your opinion about the Clean Energy Fund and how that was going to help out on some of these some infrastructure. But I also wanted to point out first that poor bike crossing that you just mentioned over 84 on 8th, that is in my opinion, a pretty integral piece of infrastructure. You mentioned, I think erroneously, that there's multiple bike lanes to the west of there, which there in fact are not. It's actually pretty tough to go north and south in that section of town.
Well, I'm not sure that we're not talking a little bit differently. I see a very large bike lane, wide bike lane, on Williams Avenue that goes all the way up into far north Portland. Also in the other direction on Vancouver Avenue, and it's very used and it's very welcome and it's perfectly fine. I don't have a problem.
No,
with
I
that.
Agree. But how do you get there? How do you get there from say south of 84? Tough.
Well, I'm not. Let me also be clear on this. I think the building of a pedestrian bike bridge at 9th across the I-84 is a perfectly fine idea. My objection is the way in which things are done in the town and the fact that that when you make decisions about what services are necessary for the people, the outer fringes of the city, particularly on the east side, are largely ignored. And there have been, in fact, traffic fatalities that would not have happened if there had been adequate signals and adequate sidewalks. And then there's the question of when the hell are they going to pave the streets of Portland? That's where I'm coming from. I'm not objecting, per se, to the idea of having a pedestrian bike street, calm street through the close-in areas, like, for example, 9th. But the process, the way in which it's done, the way in which people are dismissed and ignored. And I could give you many, many, many examples of this kind of thing. The DEQ is a business representative organization rather than representing the interests of the people. The fact that, for example, we allow unfiltered diesel trucks, unlike Washington or California, to cruise through our freeway, that we put a middle school right at the edge of that freeway, that in fact, California, as I say, California and Washington have requiring filters on their diesel trucks, which is a great improvement. We don't do that. In fact, as far as I know, we are the only state in the West Coast that allows 3 trailer units to operate on the freeways. And I think that's still true.
I think you're right about that.
Yeah. So all of this means that if you are a parent trying to raise a healthy child in this environment, you're taking a certain amount of risk that is absolutely unnecessary. If the city was really dealing with these problems appropriately, there would be better services. And these services don't exist except by the dint of a academically trained group of improvers.
Yeah. I thank you for the call.
Yeah.
The caller asked about the Portland Green Energy Fund and what it's doing to address issues like this. The answer right now is nothing yet. According to the research I just did, back in May, the city hired a manager for the Clean Energy Fund.
We like managers.
Sam Barrazzo. They're also assembling a committee to make sure that this law is implemented according to the will of the voters. And the fund is expected to start working next year, funding grants for clean energy projects in 2020.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's real nice.
Yeah. I don't know if that fund has any jurisdiction over things like pedestrian and bike bridges. I really don't know.
And at the same time, the plan for the junction of I-84 and I-5 is to make 2 more lanes for the traffic. This is something that was done a lot in L.A., and the absolute truth of the matter is you put in new lanes, and at first they're clear and people are moving easily, and then within a year or two, they're filled.
Right.
And it's basically a long parking lot from downtown Portland, from in inner east side, from south of I-84 and I-5. It's a parking lot all the way to Vancouver.
Yeah, getting over the bridge in the late afternoon, mid to late afternoon.
Forget about it.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Shabed, you're next.
No, thank you very much.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Close. Shabed is my name.
Shabed.
Anyways,
okay.
I Portland. I'm 135th and Foster. I've been out here 32 years. When I first moved here, we were part of Happy Valley. We were not part of the city. We got letters, all the neighbors got letters from the city saying that we needed to agree to be annexed. Otherwise, the city was going to screw us on sewer hookups. Currently, all our homes are on septic tank. About 2 years ago, they sent us letters after we've been annexed. We're now part of the city. We get to pay more taxes. We get to vote for a mayor, and that's about it. No services have come out here. My street ends at the end of my driveway. The other 5 homes on my street are part of a gravel road. Our city has the most unpaved roads out of any other large city in the United States. We're number one in that. So right now they sent us a letter 2 years ago saying, now my thing is, I had a farm out in Boring and I needed more electricity to it.
Uh-huh.
So I called PGE up and I said, I need a new transformer. So they go, okay, no problem. We'll put the transformer in and we'll bill it to you over your usage. After 6 months of usage, I was going through my bill and it's full of all kinds of charges. You don't know what the heck it is. And I never saw one really going down. So I called PGE up and I go, well, where's this fee on my bills? I can see it going down. And they go, well, with your usage, you've already paid that. So my question is, if PGE could amortize over my bill over a period of time to put in a new transformer, how come the city currently does not get a sewer bill from me, but will be after the sewer is in? Why can't they amortize that $36,000 over a period of years like PGE could do off my usage?
Well, it's a good
question. So I had to pay $36,000 to get a sewer in here, and my street is still not going to be paved.
Yeah, you're raising a good question. And what it looks like to me is ordinary people, working people, pay a lot for services that ought to be part of their structural system of taxation. And this has been a thing in Portland forever and ever. The annexation of East Portland to Portland was another example of this sort of thing. People pay through the nose or the you-know-what to have services that most cities provide and are included in a regular taxing bill. Portland is not a rational system. I suspect maybe if we didn't have the four at-large city council members and mayor system, which is the Galveston model, which came into the city of Galveston, Texas after a terrible hurricane. If we didn't have that model, which goes way back in time, if we had a representative government for the city, and it would cost more to have that, I have to say, we would maybe have better representation of neighborhoods. But as it is now, it is largely an elitist phenomenon, and it is largely not something that you can really get to. And crazy things are happening. There is one of the things that is really neat about Portland is after Tom McCall, who was a Republican, created a system where there would be neighborhood associations which would have access to services and would be able to represent the interests of people, since the city council itself rarely did. That system with neighborhood associations is being systematically dismantled now by well-meaning but, I believe, totally ignorant efforts by a certain member of the city council. And I beat up on her already, so I'm not going to club her anymore.
Well, I hope you get this situation straightened out, man.
No, he's right. Yeah. This is really quite a crazy situation. And what's really amazing is that the neighborhoods that are being hurt are largely working class or lower middle class neighborhoods.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, well, gee whiz, what do you suppose? It's just like the treatment of African Americans when redlining was common and the African American community was isolated and then punished with a freeway and with a supposedly a big new hospital system that never matured, never occurred.
It's the ongoing marginalization of the have-nots. It happens in virtually every arena of public discourse. Take, for example, the streetcar.
The streetcar.
Remember, we had then Mayor Sam Adams on this program many years ago.
Yeah.
When he was running for re-election.
Yeah.
And I asked him about the streetcar. I said to him, at that point they were.
Sam loved the streetcar.
He did. At that point they were talking about where they wanted to put the East Side Line.
Right.
So I asked him, you have all these existing population centers on the East Side. Why not use the streetcar to serve them? Right?
Yeah.
Why not run the streetcar up Powell or up Hawthorne or up Broadway?
Or up Sandy. Where
right.
there, all of which had streetcars at one time.
Yeah. His answer was, we don't use the streetcar to serve existing populations. We use the streetcar to drive redevelopment.
Well, that sounds like a money plan.
That's exactly what it is. And it's of a piece with everything we're talking about today.
Really, I think this is really, you know, this is kind of my issue now. I am concerned with the city that is the city that jerks, that is really not serving ordinary people. It is sweet if you have the money. Otherwise, it's a real mess and it's not progressive. And one of the things that everyone seems to think is going to solve the problem of population here, which is an issue, a lot of homeless, is to take away single-family dwellings in the poorer neighborhoods and instead put in large high-rise apartment buildings. And this will change things somehow for the better, but what it will certainly do is create ever more densification. That densification will not make life better for ordinary folks.
Let's go to the phones. Harry, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. It was announced about a week or two ago that they're going to demolish Wapato. Now, the Wapato prison has never been used, and in fact, it hasn't even been paid for. We still got five more years of property taxes to pay for it. But our county chair, Coffery, decided to sell it to the Schnitzers. And the Schnitzers offered it to the city of Portland, to the county, whatever, for homeless, for anything. The area has been developed. There's a four-lane road going to it. And the idea that no one wants to do anything about Wapato or use it at all. Right now, they're releasing prisoners, jailers. They're just booking them and releasing them. There's two dorms in the at Inverness Jail that they closed. they could be open right now. There's also two dorms downtown the downtown jail that are empty, but they refuse to use it. So it's what's going on in Wapato. We spent $51 million.
I'm not sure of the amount, but a lot.
Yeah, and they don't want they don't want to use it for anything. They could use it for the homeless. They could use it for any type of whatever, because it used to belong to the county. But the idea that Caffery sold it, and history is going to be terrible toward her, because they're going to blame her for this, you know. So,
well, I think that,
about Wapato.
Well, here's the thing: the location of it is very unfortunate, because it is out beyond where most people, particularly people without much resource, can get away from it. You know, in other words, can get to other things, including jobs. There are no services
there.
Well, they could put services in. That's not part of their plan. The whole idea of building that jail was a vast mistake. And now this is what they call a white elephant, waiting somehow for some reprieve or some purpose, which has never been fulfilled. But you're right. This is an example of poor planning, and it's an example of what we as citizens have to bear the brunt of.
Yeah, we're still paying taxes for it. And they could use it for another purpose, but Caffery does not want to use it for any purpose. She just wants to jettison it.
By the way that name's pronounced is Caffery.
Caffery.
Just so you know.
Okay, sorry, thank you.
That's okay. All right, anyway, I think you're making a good point. I think that at this point, I personally, and I can't speak for my partner here, have no real solution to that problem. The space, the Wapato mm-hmm. jail space, could function as an emergency shelter or a place for homeless people, but it would be putting those people in an isolated environment. There's no stores. It's like a food desert in the middle of nowhere.
Okay, but I mean, it could be used for other services.
Well, certainly it could be used for other things, and the imagination.
And the state also, so it's the facilities there. They just got to use it, and no one wants to do it. Even the city, even though the city is spending so much money on the homeless, here's a spot for a homeless space.
I don't think the city is spending nearly enough money on the homeless. But you're making a good point, and I want to thank you for the call.
I think I think that has a possibility to be an absolute nightmare. Putting a concentrated homeless population in an isolated
area.
Facility. Yeah.
Well, I'm not for it. I think the problem with that particular facility is that it was ill thought out to begin with, and it is isolated, and there are no services, and it is not a place you would want to live.
Yeah. I also don't like the symbolism of incarcerating the homeless, even though it wouldn't technically be a jail at that point. That's what it was built for.
But it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Robbie. Robbie's back. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Okay. I don't want to backtrack on the conversation, but I just wanted to share a quick story. When I moved to Portland in 2010, I lived in the Alberta district, the Alberta Arts District. and I was at a it was a pretty cool commune house, you know, a lot of people living in it, you know, activists and whatnot. And I absolutely loved the area. I fell in love with Portland because of the house shows, the scene, you know, the art scene. And then and it was interesting because where I was at, you know, like next door was over a half, you know, probably like a $2 million house, you know, $1 million house now. And then across the street was, you know, shacks, you know, you know, really, really cheap. And for the longest time, well, not for the longest time, but for like 3 years or 2 years, I thought that was actually a really cool thing about the neighborhood. And then as I lived there, I realized they were getting kicked out and those shacks were turning into the, you know, $1 million houses. And so it's a real shame to watch that happen. And, you know, and as you said, quasi cool.
Quasi-hip.
Joe.
Quasi-hip was a term I used, and my partner attacked me for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. No, we definitely, they definitely chased out the cool part of the town because, you know, I'm in St. John's now, and I've bounced around quite a bit, you know, getting kicked out of that area. But, yeah, it's a real shame. But I wanted to also mention on the PG&E situation, this is what happens when we have monopolies. You know, they just get to do whatever they want. They have no recoil. And then they're still funded. And quite honestly, like I had the privilege of being able to work with alternative energy sources and work on an off-grid farm. So I know the technology's there. Basically, you could have 10 to 15 car batteries, hook those up to 3 or 4 solar panels, and you could power a house easy. That's how easy this technology is. But we're still hooked up to this grid. In California, I don't know particularly about the laws here, but in California, you have to have your house hooked up to the grid. At least one structure has to be connected to the grid.
I don't know if that's true. I'm not sure it's true. I don't know.
It is true in California, but it's not true. It might not be true out here. I don't know. I'm just saying that when you have a monopoly like such, these are the types of things that they can pass, which stops the efficiency of, let's say, putting, you know, solar panels on your own home, which are now really cheap, getting 15 car batteries.
Let me interrupt you a little bit, because we do know a little bit about California. Remember, several of us, my partner and I both, spent our earlier years in California. And my understanding is there are many, many locations that are rural and are off the grid. In fact, off the grid living has become a kind of a lifestyle fetish in many parts of California. However,
sure, I guess I should say by county, yeah.
Yeah, so you're partially correct. The main problems with the electric and gas company is that they lie a lot. For example, they were storing natural gas inside a mountain and kept saying it was fine. Then when someone found a way to take a picture of the gas coming out of the place, it turned out that the people were breathing toxic fumes all over the region, and it was all being leaked out because the gas and electric company wasn't taking care of business. So we do not have honesty. We do not have a clear understanding of what's going on with these large firms.
Well, sure, but who else can you turn to? There is, like, if we were to use this capitalist structure, which you've already identified as a failure, but I mean, if we were to use that in
I don't think it's a failure. I think it needs extreme modification, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, we don't have the choice, or as I like to say, you know, the free market. We don't have the freedom to choose another power company. These are all polluting, you know, corporations that are monopolizing on the people. So we don't have that choice. And what I brought up, you have to have a structure connected to the grid, is a thing. And that's part of this monopoly. We can't get away from it. You can't just buy solar panels. I mean, like, okay, yeah, there are a lot of, you know, different Earthships, those by county basis, but good luck doing that here in the city. I guarantee you PG&E is going to be right up on you trying to figure out why you don't want to connect to their, you know, their grid.
Well, I think you're confusing apples and oranges here, but
and
I
thank
do
you for
appreciate
the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're talking about is a situation here, particularly with regard to public utilities, water, power, in the old days, telephone.
The old days of telephone.
Yeah.
Back when you were a mere 20 years old.
That's what we call geographic monopolies, and they are granted by the government, heavily regulated by the government, for the reason that it's difficult to duplicate service and have a competitive market when you're talking about infrastructure like power lines, for example.
Well, I'm sorry.
I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have half a dozen companies competing for the business of every electrical customer in Portland, for example, because you don't want to have half a dozen power grids on top of one another.
Well, yeah, and I want to throw something else out into the mix here. Several Native American groups are hearkening back to treaties made in the middle and late 1800s, which guaranteed the free flow of the Columbia River. Now, the Columbia, for the purpose of salmon fishing, which was both sacred and food, now it turns out that the dams on the river, the whole Bonneville system, is being challenged in court by these tribes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know where it's going to go. I don't think it's going to go very far. But the point is that all of us in this region are dependent on Bonneville Power as a source for our electricity. And should that be effectively challenged, again, I don't think it's very likely, but should it be effectively challenged, where are we going to go? What are we going to do?
Good question.
Well, I guess we'll all get free solar panels, huh?
Well, yeah, in a perfect world. So the geographic monopolies. They exist for a reason. In those areas where they are allowed to be for-profit geographic monopolies, Pacific Gas and Electric is a perfect example. Portland General Electric is another example. They're heavily regulated by the government. The government is involved in the setting of rates, requiring certain maintenance standards, and so on and so forth. Clearly, this is a flawed system. You look at PG&E in California, and you can see the results. People dead. Large swaths of the landscape up in flames. This is clearly a problem. Now, this has been solved by a lot of places by simply publicizing making public the utility, making it a municipal utility district, like the Water Bureau here in Portland.
Right.
In my mind, this is a much, much better state of affairs. I did a little research in the past few days after my brother and his wife were displaced. The safety record for publicly owned electrical utilities across the nation is far better than that of privately owned for-profit utilities. The safety records are better, rates are lower, reliability is better, and on and on and on. So I think there's a great argument to be made that essential services like electricity, like water, should be publicly owned and administered by the government.
I absolutely agree. I think that some fundamental, if we're going to stay capitalist, the fundamental problems that need to be addressed are things of monopoly capital, particularly in services. If those were changed, we could have a more rational model. Maybe things would be a lot better. I believe that things would be a lot better, but there's no likelihood of that. Years ago, my partner and I discovered that that some private outfit was going to burn off the toxins in the generation equipment for electricity out of the private utilities at a place very close to the centers of population in North Portland. And we fought very hard to stop that. And the main body we initially went to was the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. It turned out not only were they useless, they were fake taking notes. They were not interested in these huge meetings that were held. And it was an enormous effort. Eventually, it was a guy who was smart in Portland's bureau of, I can't remember which, but one of the bureaus, who pointed out that there were rules that would stop this thing if we used our lawyers to do that. And we won. Hmm. It was a rare victory. And at that point, it suddenly became clear that the state DEQ, much touted, wonderful thing, was a paper tiger at best.
Oh, that's so reassuring.
What?
That's so reassuring, isn't it?
It is reassuring, yeah.
So this question of monopoly capital, and particularly with the geographic monopolies granted to services that arrive in people's homes, there are models out there, as there are in virtually everything, that the United States could emulate and do better by its people. I'll just give one quick example and we'll go back to the phones. This is something I looked into last year. In the United Kingdom, they have a heavily regulated market for broadband internet service in people's homes. Here in the United States, we have exactly the opposite. Large sums of money are spent by companies like Comcast to make sure that the market is deregulated. But what they did in the United Kingdom is they said that every internet service provider even if they make the investment to build their own infrastructure, has to rent space on their lines, on their grid, for competitors to provide services. They have to do this. It's a much more regulated market than the United States. And what was the result? Prices are lower, services better and faster, and it penetrates to more parts of the society. You don't have nearly as wide a digital divide, is the term for it, right?
Yeah.
The gap between houses with internet service, which has, let's face it, become an essential service in this day and age, and the households that don't. You have a very small digital divide in the United Kingdom. You've got a big one here in the United States, all because the government in the UK decided to get involved and heavily regulate that industry, and everybody has benefited as a result.
By the way, did you see OAC carving a new hole in the head of Zuckerberg?
Yeah, wasn't that grand?
Oh, he looked so unhappy, so awkward, none didn't have anything to say as she gave him fact after fact after fact. And she looked good, yep, too. I don't want to be sexist here,
then
but
don't,
she's a...
Then don't say it.
Well,
Joe,
come
don't.
On. No, no, you're wrong.
I'm
right. You are wrong. The fact of the matter is, we are a society that judge people by how they look. It's going to be a long, long time before that disappears.
You can choose to make that judgment in private and not have it interjected into a political conversation where it's frankly not appropriate and irrelevant.
I don't agree. I do not agree. I think this is really a mistake. You're putting the horse behind the cart. The fact of the matter is, this is a culture that has for hundreds of years been more involved with the appearance of beauty than with the... Well, all right, let's drop it.
I'm going to choose to engage it or not, all right, is my point.
Okay.
Mark, let's go back to phones. Mark, you're next.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. Is it true that PG&E sent $500,000 of Oregon tax revenue to Enron instead of to Salem?
I don't know the answer to that.
That's a very interesting question.
Now, you're talking about PGE,
General
Electric?
You're talking about Portland General Electric, which is a privately owned utility.
But distinct from Pacific Gas
and
Electric.
Enron.
Okay.
It was part of Enron. The second question, why can't the old post office become a village of SROs? Single resident occupancy.
Oh, okay. The reason for that is that capitalists don't want it to be that way. There's an opportunity to make a lot of money there.
How bizarre to spend months and millions trying to find property, and then they have the property, very accessible, you know, and yet I guess they just don't want to see poor people.
No. I think they're looking for profit.
We're building boutique hotels after boutique hotels, and the only question we allow is why aren't there more boutique hotels?
I don't know, man. I don't stay in hotels much, so I can't. I don't know how to think about that.
Well,
you know,
private is.
I do know that a bunch of the boutique hotels in Portland happen to be owned by a guy who's probably going to be facing some charges.
Maybe crisis could be a turning point. And so we could talk about nationalizing public utilities and also nationalizing banks and creating a cooperative housing sector and a health sector. The state can't steal away from feeding and housing its people.
Oh, of course it can.
The state can't just increase corporate profits.
Of course it can.
I know that's what seems to be happening.
Well, therefore, it's what's going on.
Well, it's rambling incoherence. And that's all you can expect from Trump is just insults and threats.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you're saying, but you're kind of throwing a bunch of things into one big basket. The fact of the matter is that there are many societies that are both capitalist and have social democracy. They too are not antithetical. And the fact of the matter is the United States, uniquely among modern countries, really is totally in the hands of the profit sector.
As a matter of fact, John, thank you for the call, by the way. John writes into the Facebook page to say, keep in mind, the primary concern of a public utility is to maximize services to the public, while private utilities' primary concern is to maximize profits to its shareholders.
Well, exactly. That's right. It says it all.
And therein lies the problem.
Right. There are some things that are better served with a well-run public sector organization.
Healthcare.
Yeah.
Essential services.
Yeah. Electricity, water, and so on.
Yeah.
And that's indisputable. But we have been totally brainwashed as a culture. And we are not, we don't have the power and we don't have the desire to make the changes that need to occur. The result is we have a fraudulent politics, really, a fraudulent politics, and we have a system that serves much better the interests of the wealthy than it does the poor.
Yeah, absolutely correct. I can't argue with any of that, unlike some of the other stuff you said today. Yeah. All right, Harvey, you're next. Good morning.
Hi, this is Harvey in Berkeley. Well, over time, hey. Pacific Gas and Electric here in California has always fought solar initiatives. There was one, for instance, where they mandated to put solar into poor communities to give jobs to the local people. And these poor communities had an excessive amount of pollution due to being near refineries and things like that, so it would improve the air. And they fought it tooth and nail. They fought something called community choice aggregation, which is the microgrid concept. They fought it tooth and nail, and they work with the local government and the California Public Utilities Commission overall. They've always had them, in a sense, in their pocket, but not now. And the big problem with California's electric grid is that over 40% is fossil fuel powered, like methane, that generates vast amount of greenhouse gases, which cause climate destabilization and leads to more drought and out-of-control wildfires, and also fracking lubricates fault lines and triggers earthquakes. So the old model does not work anymore. We have to move to solar as fast as possible. The beautiful thing about solar panels is that once manufactured and installed, solar panels use no water, which is always a problem here in California. They generate clean, renewable electricity. They have no moving parts. No noise, they cause no chemical reactions, they emit no greenhouse gases, and they're virtually maintenance-free over their 20 to 30-year warranted lifetime. And in California right now, there's another windstorm coming, and we're all expecting longer and more power blackouts, and everybody's hunkering down. It's really a disaster that's happening here in California, and I hope that Oregon learns from this disaster and moves as fast as it possible to renewable energy and microgrid.
Yeah, no, we agree with you.
Thank you for the call.
I have many friends in California. I actually grew up in California.
So here,
here's the rule. In Southern California, where I was living in various places, there are two seasons. There is fire season and mud season. Because after the fires, the land is loose and it slides. And this has been true forever. And as population has grown, as success has taken the state, we have seen more and more of these so-called natural disasters, which really are, to a large extent, made easier by mankind. And I guess we have one more caller. Do we have time? Yes. Let's go to Ken. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having my call.
You'll have to make it real quick. Go ahead.
Sure. I want to say a few things. Back in 1977, I was 11 years old, and I suggested to my father, who was a drafting engineer, fix-it-up guy, how come every house from this point forward not be built with a solar panel or a wind generator? That was 1977. If an 11-year-old kid can come up with something like that, this country can do way, way, way better.
Ding, ding, ding.
Because we got short time. Since then, I've done a lot of other designs. My wife's car is from 1989, gets 43.3 miles to the gallon in the desert at 105 miles an hour.
Wow.
Hey.
I want that car. Okay, listen, man.
Everybody does.
Yeah. No, you're right. And I really want to thank you for the call.
Interesting conversation today.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And you and I have to have a big fight.
Yeah.
Maybe we do.
Maybe we should have it on the air. I don't know.
Probably not. Yeah.
But the point, if we could sum up the debate on today's show, is that clearly we have a vast gulf in priorities between what would benefit the vast majority of the people and what benefits a small minority of shareholders. And the shareholders seem to win every single time.
And we need to make it clear you can have a system where there is profit and still have a system that serves the people. And this choice is a false choice. And this is being promoted now by an incredibly uneducated, in fact, deliberately uneducated population of smarty pants. Smarty pants is my new word, by the way.
Deliberately uneducated population of smarty pants.
Yeah, they all have PhDs, right. But they don't know nothing.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, then. Thanks, everybody, for your participation in today's conversation, and we'll be back at you next week.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd. From 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. Project Northwest and Arcadia Beats host Hip Hop Halloween, featuring performers Figure 8 AF, Contra Killas, and Dub Dynamic, a costume contest, tarot readings, and more. Project Northwest is a pro-black, pro-women, pro-queer online zine and showcase for hip hop and R&B artists in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd, from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st, and Saturday, November 2nd, from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Portland. This two-day event celebrates the ancient tradition of welcoming back loved ones who have passed on. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. It's a benefit for Transiciones, a program at Mount Hood Community College that has helped Latino women for close to 20 years in reaching their academic and career goals. Again, that's the Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland.